Graham Company, offering women's pajamas delivered overnight and on Valentine's Day in a gift hat box at pajamagram.com.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. We're also at 90.9 FM HD2. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Well, we telephone, we text, we Twitter. The handwritten letter has become a rarity. This afternoon, we're going to talk about handwriting with a self-confessed penmanship nut. Her name is Kitty Burns Florey, and she's the author of the new book, Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting. The book explores the history of handwriting and looks at the golden age of handwriting. It's filled with stories about people who have made a mark on handwriting, so to speak, and it asks the question, is handwriting important? Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation this afternoon. Join us with your questions and comments about handwriting. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Kitty Burns Florey. She's a veteran copywriter who is the author of 9 novels and many short stories and essays. She's also the author of the bestseller, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, The Quirky History and Lost Art of Diagramming Sentences. Script and Scribble, her new book, is published by Melville House Publishing. And you'll find more about the book and our guest at her website, www.kittyburnsflorey.com. And Florey is spelled F-L-O-R-E-Y. Again, our phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Kitty Burns Florey, it's good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure to talk with you. I'd like to listeners to know here at the outset that you're not a Luddite. You love email. And, you know, the good old days may not be as good as we remember them. Nevertheless, you think there's a lot to be said about the benefits of handwriting. What are the benefits of handwriting?
Well, the benefits of handwriting begin with the fact that we need to know how to write. You know, no matter how much time we spend at the computer, and God knows I spend an awful lot of time at the computer, like it or not, we still have to write things down during the day, sometimes just a few notes, sometimes something more extensive. But everybody, as one of the calligraphers I interviewed for this book said, try to get through the day without writing anything down. And so as long as we're going to be writing things down, why not write things down legibly and even possibly beautifully?
And in the course of writing this book, you talked with a woman or corresponded with her, or perhaps both, a woman by the name of Kate Gladstone, a professional handwriting repair woman. And here I've got a few questions for you. How often is she employed? By whom? And how does she go about the task?
Well, she's not the only handwriting repair person in this country. There are quite a few of them. They are probably people who don't make their main living doing it, but I know that Kate gets a lot of work, and a couple of other people that I spoke to who do this also get a lot of work, and most of their work comes from, and this may not be a big surprise, hospitals who have them come in and instruct doctors in improving their handwriting. Because doctors, I don't think doctors have such terrible handwriting. I think everybody has terrible handwriting. But when you're a doctor and you're writing a prescription or you're writing up a note about some procedure that you've done or that you're recommending, you need to write neatly. Yeah. And the medical profession is very much aware that this is a problem. And doctors, when they're renewing their certification, can take a course in handwriting repair. As I think it's under the patient safety category, it's really it enhances their job.
Yeah. Well, how does she go about the task? And I know that you consulted her about your hand. What was the experience like?
Well, we did it through the mail. Kate is a proponent of italic handwriting, and so am I. I have become completely converted to italic handwriting. And italic handwriting is difficult to describe on the radio, but if you ever see it written, it's really quite beautiful. There are several examples in Script and Scribble. It's a handwriting that was devised in Italy in the 16th century. It is, I would describe it as partly printed and partly cursive, partly connected. It's a handwriting that is flexible enough that you can connect the letters that you feel comfortable connecting and that seem to make sense to be connected and leave others unconnected. And it just flows very naturally. It's a handwriting that doesn't have a printed version and a written version. In other words, it's not a printed and then cursive. It's just one script. Kids could start learning it in first grade and go on and use it all their lives. And in fact, they do that. There are programs that are available that are taught in some enlightened school districts.
Yeah. Well, my handwriting has turned out to be a mixture of written and of cursive and printing, but it doesn't look italic.
Mm-hmm.
And the other question I have is, you know, when people in the audience, listeners, will be familiar with what something looks like in typeface if it's been italicized. So,
yes, it's a right slanting script, which is supposed to be the easiest for people to use. It's what we do naturally.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, picking up your pencil or your pen, does that slow you down?
Well, it's certainly slower than typing if you're a fast typist. I type like the wind, and I write at a normal speed. So when I need to do something really, really quickly, of course I turn to the typewriter, to the computer, to the keyboard. And to be completely honest, I use the keyboard for almost everything that I do. But I have really tried, especially since I started talking to people in the course of researching this book, and I've become so much aware of all this, I've really tried to keep my handwriting decent by writing a little more than I used to. I write notes to people more often than I used to. I take notes. When I do take notes, which I have to do fairly often for various reasons, I try to take them neatly, and I try to write as rapidly as I can and keep it legible. And it's a bit of a challenge, but I'm here to tell you it can be done. My handwriting was terrible until I got it repaired.
Yeah. Learning to write is a slow and cumulative process. We learn how to write as children, and it takes some time, and there can be some frustration. But you write that you found during the course of researching this book that there may be an intrinsic and lasting value in having children deal with a little frustration here.
Well, that seems to be what a lot of people think, and certainly some of the educators that I talk to felt that way, that if a child has to work at it a little bit more than they work at other things, then it's going to stick in their minds better. And, you know, when you think about all the things that children learn, they might learn to play a musical instrument. They might learn the rules of a game. You know, these are all things that don't come immediately and don't come naturally. Even keyboarding certainly is something that they have to work at. And, you know, I think we can all relate to the idea that the more we have to concentrate on something, the more that it's going to stay in our minds.
Yeah. And then over time, as children master writing, they pick up speed. And that's also apparently important in a cognitive sense, right?
Yes, it is. It's, you know, when you think about how many years people hand wrote before keyboards, even typewriters, were invented, and when you think about the quantities of stuff that was produced simply by people handwriting, and then you compare that to the idea that handwriting is too hard, too slow, and not useful to children today, it sounds a little crazy. It's handwriting is important for children because there's a direct connection between what they're doing with their hand and what's going on in their heads. When they're learning to read, they focus their attention so much better when they're actually writing a word that they're learning, and rather than picking it out on a keyboard. You know, the connection between their brain and their hand is direct. There's nothing. There's no middleman. The pencil is, you know, doing directly what they tell it to do. So it's something that needs to have more research done about it, but it's something that the teachers that I spoke to, even if they hadn't actually done experiments on this idea, could see constantly how this was true for the children in their classes. And they told me this over and over again, how important it is.
Yeah. Now, you start out in Script and Scribble by saying that you're part of the last generation for whom handwriting was taught as a vital skill. How is handwriting taught today?
Well, handwriting is still taught. It's certainly true that handwriting is taught in schools and that there are lots of handwriting programs that are marketed and used in schools. But once children learn to print in first grade and then they learn cursive in second or third grade, gradually the need to use that handwriting tapers off. And by the time that they're in fifth or sixth grade, they are hardly ever using it. They're allowed and, in fact, encouraged to keyboard most of their assignments. And this isn't true in every school, and it's certainly not true of every teacher, but it's a growing trend. So, yes, they learn it, but, you know, if you don't use it, you definitely will lose it. It's like anything else. And by the time they, say, graduate from eighth grade, a lot of them have handwriting that has deteriorated very badly and is almost illegible. And by the time they graduate from high school, this is not an exaggeration. There are a lot of people in this country who can sign their name, but once they get beyond that, they're using block printing. They really don't have a legible script that is rapid and that they can rely on, like to take notes in a class, in college. There's a lot of it's a problem.
Yeah, so everyone today is taking notes on laptops.
They're trying to, but, you know, there are also now professors who are not allowing that to happen in their classes because they're not taking notes. They're, you know, they're answering their email and they're surfing the web and they're looking at YouTube and, you know.
Checking up on the Facebook.
Yeah, there's a lot to do when you have a computer in front of you. But if you have a pen and pencil and a pencil and a piece of paper in front of you, basically you can take notes and that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. The writer's bump is going away, if not already gone. I had a huge one as a kid. I still have it, but it's hardly noticeable now.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and I've been curious. I've approached a few people and said, "Which hand do you write with? May I see it?"
Did you find any writer's bump?
Yeah, it does seem to be a generational thing. Younger people don't seem to have them.
They don't, and they're amazed when I even mention it. You know, younger people who haven't a clue what a writer's bump is, they say, "What? You actually had this ugly thing on your hand?" And when you look back, you know, we all had these ugly things on our hand, and we never thought twice about them.
Yeah, and we had to wield those huge pencils, you know. Oh, my goodness. In Script and Scribble, you have pages of your handwriting reproduced from grade school notebooks. What do you recall most vividly about learning to write?
I can remember that it was actually very thrilling, and it's a shame if children don't still feel this, but it was very thrilling to learn how to write that cursive script that put, we learned it in third grade at my school, and it put us so far above those first and second graders. You know, we became gods because we could do this, and we could write script that they couldn't even read. And I just loved it. I loved that it connected and that it kind of just flowed along like that. And I remember that very well. I remember being taught by Sister Victorine in the third grade, and I remember what she looked like and how she would teach us and what she sounded like when she would swish up to the blackboard with her long veil trailing and show us how to write, you know, one of those capital S's, you know, that looks like a big figure eight.
Yeah. Every day there was a new letter. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got to those pages of notebooks where we, okay, today we're going to practice our K.
Right,
or
which
J.
I reproduce in the book only because my mother saved everything.
Yeah, she
so
did.
I do have my pages of J's and K's.
And from the time where you were a 3-year-old when you were fascinated by the letter W.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have that in there too. I mean, I blush to admit there's really a lot of stuff like that, but it does illustrate what I was talking about.
Yeah. Now, before being taught cursive, you learned to print letters and words. Why had that been the practice? Why learn printing before cursive?
Well, you know, printing wasn't even invented until the 1920s. It was brought over to this country by an English woman. Before that, children had started out just learning cursive writing. They were learning either Spencerian script or they were learning the Palmer method, depending on whether it was the 19th or the 20th century. There was no printing, but that block printing that is called ball and stick, for obvious reasons, if you look at a lowercase d or a lowercase mm-hmm. c, that's what it is, began to be introduced into the schools, and it caught on. I really don't know why, except that I suppose it is easier than Palmer method, which is the very, very flowing, very fancy cursive that we learned in my generation, and it sounds like yours in second and third and fourth grade. So it caught on, and it's unfortunate because that means that children have to learn this one script when they're 6, and then when they're 7 or 8 or 9, they're learning a completely different script, block printing, ball and stick printing, and any kind of cursive script, whether it be a fancy Palmer method or a stripped-down italic, have very little in common.
Yeah. A couple of thoughts here. Today, children are learning the alphabet at a much younger age, and I suspect are also being asked to print those letters at a much earlier age. That's one thought. And then the other is, does it allow a child a way to form letters that is a little slower, and you can master that? Maybe it's a little simpler than cursive.
It is simpler than cursive, and I don't think that cursive should be taught in first grade by any means, but as I said before, I think everybody should just be learning italic. Yes, I think probably it is easier for them to do printing, and I'm sure that that's why it caught on and why it's still with us. This has been almost 100 years now, and printing is still being taught in first grade or kindergarten.
Mm. Well, tell us something about Spencer and Palmer. Who were these fellows?
Well, they were the two biggest handwriting Americans that have ever lived. Spencer dominated the 19th century with Spencerian script, which he invented as an outgrowth of, he didn't invent it, but it was an outgrowth of the copperplate script that had been in use and that we're familiar with from looking at the writing in, for example, the Declaration of Independence. That was 18th century copperplate. But Spencer took that script and ran with it, and he was a very, very sensitive young man who was fascinated with handwriting from the time he was born. He just loved it, and he became fanatically interested in having everybody write a very, very beautiful, fancy, flowery, shaded script that he wrote himself, and he became a teacher of handwriting and spread the gospel of Spencerian script across the country so that by the end of that century, even by the middle of that century, anybody who could write at all was being taught, had been taught Spencerian, and that's what they were writing, some version of it. They were writing very, very fancy script. And then along came Palmer at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, and he was like Spencer, he was completely fascinated by handwriting. He had a job at one point as a clerk in an office, and he observed that the clerks who could write the most efficiently, the fastest, and got the most work done were guys who were writing, they were all men in those days, they were writing a stripped-down version of Spencerian that really wasn't that fancy and didn't take that long and didn't require a lot of, you know, lifting your hand off the paper and making elaborate curlicues on your capital letters, et cetera. So he devised his own script, which is the famous Palmer method that most of us were subjected to at some point in our lives. Palmer Method was a stripped-down Spencerian, but it was still, as we know, a pretty fancy script.
Yeah.
But it was quick, you know, compared to anything else that had been used before. It was a very rapid script. It was designed for business. This country was becoming a nation of business people. And so to say that that caught on like wildfire is not an understatement. Everybody was learning Palmer Method in the 20th century right up until the 60s. Versions of it are still being taught.
Yeah. And for those in the audience who are kind of thinking Spencerian, what does that look like? The old Coca-Cola logo is an example of that style.
Right. That's something we see every day.
Yeah. And, you know, long ago, writing was for the wealthy. When and how did that change?
Well, I think it began to change in the 19th century, and probably, you know, Spencer and Palmer were not alone. There were a lot of what were called handwriting masters. There was an interest in handwriting, and since compulsory schooling became extended to the 8th grade during the 19th century, children learned reading, writing, and arithmetic, and writing was important. So that the average school child, whether from a wealthy family or a poor family, if they were in school, they were learning to write, and they were learning to write neatly, and they were learning to write fancily. So that became democratized in the middle of the 19th century.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer and editor Kitty Burns Florey. We're talking with her today about her latest book, Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join the conversation with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
I'm calling to tell you about my experience with handwriting, which is perhaps unique. I'm a 20th century product from the early 20th century. And in grade school, we somehow or other, I guess I'd learned from my older siblings how to write, and my writing was pretty much of a scribble until I got into the second room. It was a two-room school. And in the fifth grade, we had a new school, and we added a kindergarten room, and we got a kindergarten teacher, which we hadn't had. And our fifth grade teacher, who was the principal, said we needed all of us to have a little instruction from the kindergarten teacher on how to print, because we scrawled. We didn't have much uniformity to our writing. We didn't know about ball and stick. Is that what you call it? Anyway, so in the fifth grade, I learned to print neatly. And then a young man came and sat beside me who hadn't been in the school before, and he had a lovely cursive hand. And we used to have dictations sometimes. And I always did a race with him. I was always looking to see if he could keep up any faster than I could. And I was combining, after I'd learned this printing, I was combining my letters so that I didn't have to lift my hand, and it was pretty legible still. I mean, it was fairly good writing of connected, printed letters. And usually I could keep up with him. And when I went to high school, I thought, oh, gosh, I'm going to have to learn how to write, really write. And nobody said anything about my handwriting. So I've, like someone your guest mentioned at the beginning, really the only thing I ever learned to do in a Palmer method, or not Palmer, but the next one, which is more or less standard, was to do my name, sign my name. So to this day, and I'm in my 70s, I'm still printing, and so are my classmates from that grade school. And we got pretty fast just by connecting the printed letters. So
I think printing can be quite fast. I don't think it has to be slow. A lot of people do a kind of printing. They connect some, they don't connect others, and it goes along pretty smoothly.
Yeah. Well, we used to race. It was kind of fun. Another thing I want to mention, I don't want to tie up your line, but was that my great aunts lived in Boston, and mother had some letters from them when she was a girl or whatever. And paper was such a scarce commodity that the writing, as I'm sure you know, but maybe some of the listeners haven't seen it, would go both ways on the same side of the paper. Mm. Very carefully written on the horizontal, and then over it, and vertical, would be written the rest of the letter, or both sides of both one page, because paper was not easy to come by. Mm. So we had some samples of that in the house. I would wish we still had them, but I don't suppose we do. Mm.
Interesting.
Anyway.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Yeah.
Kitty, you want to comment?
Yeah, I've seen some of those letters that are crossed like that. And it's very interesting, the handwriting, because the handwriting in the days when people were doing that was so regular and so neat, it actually is not that difficult to read them, even though they cross each other on the page.
Let's take another call, a listener in Danville. Line 4, hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm in my 80s and was brought up on the Palmer Method in grade school in Southern Illinois. And as I think we started it in second or third grade, and of course we had all those little O's and slopes and so on to write, like spiral wire. But we continued it in that school until at least seventh grade. And I know that the people who had, in my seventh grade class, those students who had already had their Palmer certificate got out of school 15 minutes early, and the others stayed to practice their Palmer Method. Well, in the middle of seventh grade, my dad was transferred to Madison, Wisconsin. They did not do the Palmer Method, and all my classmates had atrocious handwriting in those schools. Now, for the last 17 years, I have been volunteering at a local grade school, and they don't write very well, but the point that I have not heard yet addressed is how they hold their pencil. They do not hold it to be able to make the small muscular or the controlled muscular activities that are necessary for writing, no matter how you do it.
I didn't realize that they weren't being taught to hold their pencils properly. That would, of course, be the first thing that you'd have to know.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a substantial writer's bump on my middle finger, and they don't. It just astonishes me. Most of the time I have, the last 7 or 8 years have been in third grade, and they are just beginning to learn cursive then, but I just rarely see one that holds their pencil in the approved method, and I don't see how they have any control. Also, one point that I had a friend who had a young child, and she did not want that child to have any coloring books because she thought it would stifle his artistic motives or expressions. And I have thought later that I think in kindergarten, coloring books, at least if you try to keep within the lines, you are starting to exercise those muscles that you can control when you are writing. Have you ever thought of that?
Mm. That's a good point.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
This afternoon. So, yeah, that was part of learning how to write, as I'm recalling now, was how we hold the pencil, how you hold a crayon.
Yeah, you'd think that would be the first thing that they would learn, and it is important. And you know, it's all about small muscle control. Kids at that age are really struggling with that, and you know, all that plays into writing, and certainly holding the pen properly would be the first thing. And the other thing that strikes me is that when that caller said that they were doing handwriting right up and through the seventh grade, in my school we also, it was very important right up through seventh and eighth grade, and we were still judged on our handwriting, and we were still given, as I recall, a grade in handwriting.
Hmm. Interesting. I can't remember when we stopped handwriting, or penmanship, mm-hmm. as it was called.
We weren't having formal instruction, but since we had to handwrite everything in those days, we couldn't help being judged on it.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener on line 2 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'll try to be brief. I went to the Champaign schools a long time ago. We did not learn the Palmer method. We learned what they called the Zehner Bloser mm-hmm. method, which I think is pretty much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, I was left-handed. We had a terrible time, and it's just when you said it was natural to go to the right, it isn't for a left-handed person. And we had a terrible time trying to hold our pens properly and to write properly, and we finally, the left-handed friends and I, just gave up and worked out our own method of handwriting. And it's terrible, but people can read it.
Well, I'm left-handed, and I had kind of a tough time at it in school at first because they tried to get me to switch to my right hand, and then they gave up on that pretty quickly. But my parents were both left-handed, and all they had to do for me was to turn the paper to the right.
Right.
And then I was off and away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we did that, but we couldn't get it to slant to the right, and we ended up, and I still do this, writing up, turning, go around and approach the paper from the top. But I just wondered if anything is being done for left-handed kids now.
Hmm. That's a good question.
It is. I don't know if they're teaching handwriting any differently to left-handers than to right-handers in schools now. I have no idea. In my book, I write about my two best friends in elementary school, both of whom were left-handed and both of whom handled it differently, and both of whom have lovely handwriting.
Yeah.
Everybody that I know had to figure out their own way of handling
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call. In high school, when we were still having to write everything, we had typewriters and typing class. The desktops had an armrest on the right, so
mm-hmm.
left-handed students had to have their arm hanging off in the air.
Mm-hmm.
That was terrible.
It is, and I remember also that. And I remember my friend Eileen in seventh grade; her arm completely curled around the desk, you know, as if she were holding a great big ball or something. And she's writing like that. You know, she produced beautiful script, but it certainly didn't look comfortable.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 3. Hi.
I have a question and a comment. I worked in the Decatur schools in the 80s, and they were using, at that time, the Danielian print, which kind of curves, you know, has a little curvy tail on the A, for instance, so it'll kind of connect to your next letter, which I thought was a really nice kind of printing for transition. Do you have any, do you know if that's still popular, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, that is still being taught in schools, and Danielian is pretty nice. I think, again, it doesn't go as far as the italic version goes in eliminating unnecessary little strokes and stuff that kind of get in the way. Parts of Danielian still look like Palmer method to me. You know, they still do the big capital D with the loop on the bottom and the loop on the top, and
mm-hmm.
they still do the big capital G that, you know, kind of has a loop and then a stick-up part, and the capital L that's very graceful and beautiful looking, but it's not necessary to make all those loops and scoops. But Danielian is getting there.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Well,
you know,
I thought it was a nice transition.
Yeah.
It made it easier to transition to script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it probably is. It has a little, it's more of a transitional, it's certainly less fancy than Palmer or Zehner Bloser.
Okay. And then a comment, I just, in December, finished translating a letter, German language letter from my Swiss grandfather, a family history letter. And he was writing, he was in his 60s. And when I made a copy for each of my kids, and when my oldest son looked at it, he said, "Did somebody write this?" And I said, "Well, it's a photocopy." He said, "No, I mean, it looks like it was made by a machine." his lines are perfectly horizontal. I mean, they're perfectly even, and it's not the old German script, so as far as European writing goes, it was fairly easy to read because they write much more angular, kind of sharper points than we do. But in there, he mentioned he had a sixth-grade education, which was standard. He was born in the 1860s at that time, and then went to was an apprentice with, I think he wrote three afternoons or evenings a week of supplemental schooling, which we might call a apprentice instruction, or it was classroom instruction at any rate. And so the school where he had that instruction had an exhibit, I think when he was 19, in the Swiss National Exhibition in the education section. And his penmanship notebook was right up front, and they won the gold medal. His school won the gold medal, he thought, because of his penmanship. But I found that really interesting because he was in his late teens, and that was still considered important. So that would have been in the mid-1880s.
That's not surprising. Handwriting was very important in those days, you know, because that was the only way you could communicate.
And conduct business.
Everything was written.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call. And let's take another call for our guest, writer and editor, Kitty Burns Flory, author of Script and Scribble. Our caller next up is on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm interested in the comments early on about how writing a word helps children remember a word. I work with young children who have a lot of trouble with focus, who have dyslexia, and that is so very true that when they can write the word, feel the word, get the whole gestalt of the word, it really makes a difference. And I was wondering if you've heard about some of the, I don't know if you call it research, but observations in clinics that work with children like this, where once they learn cursive writing, it's as though their reading seems to get better, and they can feel the whole flow of a word, and they can read better because of that. I mean, I'm fascinated with the idea and wish I knew more about it.
I wish that more were being done on this subject, the feeling is that there will be, that people are starting to get interested in that whole concept, especially for learning disabled children. A woman that I spoke to who teaches learning disabled kids and also teaches teachers of learning disabled kids said that it really is, just as you said, it's really magical, the way that it focuses their attention, and in a way that just looking at a letter on a page or tapping a key is never going to do.
Well, thank the listener for her call, and let's take another call. Listener on line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I find this a fascinating topic, and I'd be interested to hear what you would have to say, I guess, about how gender kind of plays into difference in script. I taught middle school and grade school for a while, and one striking difference, it seems, is between young boys' handwriting and the handwriting of young girls. And there seem to be very distinct and kind of, generalizable differences between them. And I would be interested in hearing your thoughts on those kind of differences in gender as they play themselves out in writing.
Little boys, fine motor skills lag behind those of little girls. So girls are going to have better handwriting for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that as a result of that, boys get turned off about handwriting. They get discouraged, and they start to think of it as something that sissies do, that it's for girls, and why even bother? And that seems to be something that persists, throughout their writing life, even though there's really no reason to think that way.
right.
But traditionally, girls have better handwriting than boys, partly because they can and partly because girls like it. You know, they just kind of get into it. Even girls now, you know, little girls are still putting a little heart over their eyes and stuff like that. You know, they love producing that flowery script.
Sure. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. To follow up on that, are there programs, strategies to get boys engaged in reading and writing? And here I'm thinking of the great popularity of graphic novels. Any thoughts there?
I don't know anything specifically about anything that might be being done for boys, except that I do know that teachers now are aware of this fact that, you know, when I was in school, it was just that we girls were the stars of the handwriting class, and we were, you know, we were praised and given all kinds of attention and asked to go up to the blackboard and display our beautiful script while the boys are just sitting there, you know, fuming. But certainly teachers are more aware now that it's not entirely their fault.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 3. Hi.
Hi. Interesting topic. I guess I was one of those little boys that kept up with the girls when I was in elementary and high school because I had a very good penmanship, whether I either used cursive or print. But as I got to be older and more educated, if you will, college and graduate school, then when I started in my professional life, my writing got progressively worse. And then I hit the computer age and word processing, and it continued to get progressively worse. I guess where I'm going with this, if from a practical standpoint, what's the, except for writing your name, why even concentrate in this area? Because everything is kind of word processed today. And that's what our future is about.
It is certainly true that word processing is what it's about, and we use handwriting less and less, and we need it less and less. But that really doesn't mean that we should just get rid of it, because there are lots of times when we really do need to use it. I have in the book, I have several examples. Many of them are sort of melodramatic, but someone was telling me about Hurricane Katrina, and when they lost power down there, one of the results of that was that their power was out for so long that in hospitals, which, you know, as I was saying, the handwriting is bad enough, without the use of computers, they had to write down everything that was happening, you know, all the procedures, right, you know, any kind of medications that they were giving out. And of course, everybody was rushed, and half the time they didn't have any light to write by, you know, so they were using flashlights. Anyway, it was a complete mess. And once electricity was restored and the computers came back up, a lot of those notes that were taken during that time were not legible. And the medical personnel was completely confused about what had happened and what was needed. So, I mean, that is an extreme example, but it's not an isolated case. We do lose power, the computers do crash, and the two things that struck me when I was writing the book that none of the big keyboard proponents really wanted to talk about were two things. One is we are having a kind of an energy crisis, and the idea that people's home computers are on all day long and that every single thing everybody writes down is written on a computer could become a bigger problem than it even is now. You know, it's not nothing. And nobody has a solution for this except that, you know, people tell me that manufacturers are trying to make computers greener and less, you know, and more energy efficient, which is fine. But, you know, the use is proliferating so much that it seems to me that we are going to come to a crisis. And the other thing that really troubles me is that when you have kids starting to keyboard in kindergarten, And from you know, first, second, third grade on up for the rest of their lives, everything that they communicate is going to be typed on a keyboard. So I would say to people things like carpal tunnel syndrome, you know, repetitive stress, and nobody has an answer for that. This is very bad for your hands and your wrists and your arms to have to use a keyboard for every single thing you do, to use a mouse, you know. I don't know where this is going to go, but I do know that it's going to be a problem.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up here in just a moment. You know, thinking about these issues, who doesn't love getting a handwritten letter in the mail from a friend or a loved one? What's the future? Do you think email and the text message will deal the death blow to the letter?
I think that's a strong possibility, but I'm hoping, I feel optimistic that that is not going to happen as rapidly as and as on a huge scale as it appears to be. When I was writing Script and Scribble, I was amazed and gratified to find that there are an awful lot of people who really believe that handwriting is important and who really are pursuing it. There are websites, there are organizations, there are pen collectors, there are paper specialists, there are people who... There are pen pal organizations where you have to handwrite the letters. I really think that it's like everything. There's going to be a backlash, and I hope that my book will contribute to that. But, you know, people who have who've gotten in touch with me since they've read my book, and there are a lot of them, or since they've heard me interviewed here and there, write and say, you know, I sat down today and wrote a letter to whatever, to my friend, to my aunt. I've started keeping a diary. I think this is really important. I'm trying to improve my handwriting. And I really think it's going to come back.
Yeah. Well, last night I sat down and tried my hand at the Spencer method and had a fairly good time, but it was kind of frustrating. But I'm up for a challenge, so I'm gonna work on it.
And, that would be a challenge.
Yeah. And I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me. It was fun.
Kitty Burns Florey is the author of Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting. The book is published by Melville House Publishing. More about our guest and the book, Script and Scribble, at her website, which is www.kittyburnsflorey.com. And Florey is spelled F-L-O-R-E-Y. It is 1:52 Central Time, and for those of you listening on the radio this afternoon, there was a period there where we were off the air, I think due to an electrical storm. Nevertheless, we are back on the air at AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and 3 Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn, joined now by Todd Gleason. He has settlement prices now for us from Chicago and Kansas City.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Let's take a look at those numbers in Chicago on a very wet afternoon in the Midwest. Futures like this for the wheat bit, down 12 and 3 quarter cents for that nearby March contract. The soft red had a high today of $5.56.5 in the March, the low at $5.42, settlement price at $5.43.25, down 12 and 3 quarters on the day. The May futures, 13 cents lower, $5.69 the high, the low at 54 and 3 quarters, settlement price at $5.56. In July wheat, $5.81.25 on the high, the low at $5.66, settlement price $5.68.25, down 13 and 1 quarter. March hard red winter wheat in Kansas City traded 11 cents lower at the end of the day with a high price of $5.88.5 and a low at $5.76, settled 11 cents lower. March hard red winter wheat down at $5.78 at the end of the day. March corn futures $3.76.5, the high, the low at $3.68, settlement price for the March corn at $3.68.5, down 8 and a quarter. May futures $3.86.25 the high, the low at 78, settled 378.5, down 8.5 cents. In July corn futures, $3.96 the high, the low at 387.5, settlement price at $3.88, 9.25 lower. September 405.5 the high, the low at 398.75, settlement price 398.25, down on that low, 9.25 lower for the day. In December futures, 10.5 cents the loss, 419.25 the high, the low at 409.75, settled just a quarter of a cent above the low at $4.10 a bushel, down 10.5 cents for the December 2009 corn contract. That's the new crop harvest month. March futures at 2010, 423.75 the settlement price, down 10.5 cents. March crude oil, $1.35 lower at this hour. Ethanol is just about unchanged, and RBOB gasoline now is three cents higher. Soy complex for the day. March beans at 9.78 on the finish of the day, down 16 cents, the high at 9.96, the low at 9.76. A settlement price there at $9.78, down 16. May futures for the afternoon finished the day like this. The May beans settled in that pit at $10.25, 9.87, the settlement price, down 8.25 on the afternoon. And the May beans for the day had a high price at $10 at a low at $9.80. Once again, the settlement price, I got that wrong. It was $9.82 on the settlement price, down 18 and a quarter. July futures, $9.87 and three quarters, 19 and a half lower, $10.05 the high, low at $9.85 and three quarters. Settlement price for the August contract, 20 and a half cents lower, $9.93 and three quarters the high, the low at $9.77 and three quarters. Settlement price at $9.77 and a half, down 20 and a half. And September beans, 21 and a half cents lower, $9.62 the high, the low at $9.42 and a half. Settlement price at $9.45 and one half on the afternoon. And next year's November, new crop, 21 and a half lower, 938 and a half the high, the low at 15 and a quarter. Settlement price at 917 and a half, down 21 and a half cents for November soybeans. March bean meal, $6.40 lower on the afternoon, 312.20 the high, the low at 305.50. Settlement price at 305.70. May bean meal at 309.80 high, the low at 302.50. Settlement price at 303. $7.10 lower. March bean oil futures, 34.01 the high, the low at 33.15. Settlement price at 33.18, down 46 cents. The May bean oil, 34.33, the high, the low at 33.50, settled 46 cents lower at 33.51. Here's the way the numbers settled from the CME Group's livestock side. Futures like this for the day, nearby February live cattle futures. Well, we do have this interruption at the moment. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has just issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Clark County, right here in east central Illinois. The National Severe Weather Service meteorologist directed a severe thunderstorm capable of producing penny-sized hail. This storm was located near Oblong, on or about 9 miles west of Robinson's, and it's moving northeast at 65 miles an hour. Locations impacted include Hudsonville and West Union. Other locations in the warning include Annapolis and Eaton. If you're in the path of this storm, prepare immediately for damaging winds, large hail, deadly cloud, to ground lightning. People outside should move, of course, to a shelter, preferably inside a strong building, but stay away from the windows and report any severe weather damage to your local emergency manager. Once again, the National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Clark County in east central Illinois. It's also in effect for Crawford County in east central Illinois. Let's continue on now with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Live cattle futures settled like this from the CME. High price at $84.95, the low at $84.40. Settlement price, $84.52.5, 25 cents lower. April futures, $88.20 the high, the low at $87.55. Settlement price at $87.60, 45 cents lower. In the June live cattle, a settlement price, 22.5 cents lower at $85.17.5. The August at $85.97.5. Their settlement down 22.5 cents as well. Feeder cattle, nearby March contract, 30 lower for the day, $96.45 the high, the low at $95.30. Settlement price at $95.40 in the feeders, 30 lower. April futures down 70 cents, $97.50. The top, the bottom at $96.30. Settlement price at $96.40, down 70 for the April feeder cattle. And the May contract, 57.5 cents lower at $97.90. The August feeders at $99.75, down 72.5 cents. Lean hog futures settled like this. February contract gained 85 cents, $57.80 the high, the low at $57.10. Settlement price at $57.60, up 85 for the Feb live hogs. April futures 2.5 cents lower, $62.50 the high, the low at $61.90. Settled 2.5 lower at $62.27.5 for the April lean hogs. The May contract at $74.50 was a dime higher. The June futures at $75.30 at the end of a Tuesday, or rather Wednesday trading day, 25 cents higher at $75.30 for the June lean hogs. I'll be back at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time with a complete look at the agricultural futures markets. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director, Henry Frain. The producer for the Afternoon Magazine is